Commissioners will come to order. Time is 3:35. We have Senator Green, Senator Stidman is AWOL, Senator McGuire is AWOL, Senator Wagner, actually Senator Wagner and Senator McGuire excused. Senator Stevens is with us, Senator Wilikowski and Huggins. Today we have two bills to hear. The first is Senate Bill 109, Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which we have previously heard, and it would be the intent with some success today to be able to move this out of committee, and then we'll be hearing Senate Bill 96, establishing a renewable energy fund. The sponsor of that is Senator Ellis, but we will start with Senate Bill 109, Ms. Cheryl Sutton. And if you both would put yourselves on the record and your affiliation, and we are prepared.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Sutton. I am the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee staff for Representative Ralph Samuels. Senate Bill 109 was introduced through the Rules Committee by request of LBNA. In addition to that, it was by request of the Commission. Last evening, a committee substitute, revised sectional, and revised sponsor statement were distributed to the members. The House has a companion bill that is exactly like the CS you have before you. It was heard in the House Oil and Gas Committee yesterday and was moved from committee without objection. The committee substitute reflects changes resulting from interactions between the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, AOGA, and other industry members. I believe AOGA will be testifying today, and I believe also you have some industry members, or at least one industry member here to testify. Chairman John Norman from the Commission is here, and I will defer to him on as the expert on the bill. It was by their request. I did go through, and I am happy to go through it. The sectional reflects it, but I'm happy to go through. I went through section by section and made notes relative to what the changes are, and they're very simple.
The changes.
Would you like me to do that?
Yep.
Okay. Section 1 remains unchanged from the original bill. Section 2 remains unchanged from the original bill. Section 3 remains unchanged. Section 4 is reworded but has no substantive changes from the original bill. Section 5 remains the same. Section 6 remains the same. Section 7 is reworded for clarity but has no substantive change from the original bill. Section 8 is reworded for clarity, but again, no substantive change. Section 9 remains unchanged from the original bill. Section 10 remains unchanged. Section 11 is reworded for clarity, but has no substantive change. Section 12 is reworded for clarity and adds, quote, an underground interjection well for the purpose of gas storage, end quote, to the Commission's list for permitted wells. And Chairman Norman will speak to that in a few minutes. Section 13 remains the same as the original bill. Section 14 combines the material from the original bill contained in sections 14 through 17 and clarifies the language, reorders some of it and clarifies it. The substantive change in the committee substitute is on page 8, lines 18 through 19. And it deals with the civil penalty the commission may impose. And what it says is it is not more than $100,000 for the initial violation and not more than $10,000 for each day thereafter on which the violation continues. The remainder of the section incorporates the language from the original bill, sections 14 through 17. The remainder of the bill is sections are the same as the original bill, just renumbered. Reflect that okay. Consolidation.
Okay. Question by members. I tell you, if we would, Mr. Norman, if you would address specifically Section 14, which appears to be, is that the most substantive piece, if you will, on page 8?
Yes. Among the, there are several that are somewhat substantive, but this certainly is ranks
let's,
high.
Let's start with high. That, and then we will take. Allow
Very
you
good.
To take the lead.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Norman. I'm the chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. The commission is officed at 333 West 7th Avenue, Anchorage, Alaska, and we would invite all of you members to please stop by sometime at your convenience. We've got a lot going on there, and we'd love to give you each individual briefings on the important work going on. With reference to Section 14, this is a penalty section, and it is being updated. The civil penalty has not been updated for, to my knowledge, a lot of years, almost 20 years at least, and before that, a number of years prior. This penalty provision that you have before you in Section 14, which proposes an amendment to 3105-150A, would establish a $100,000 penalty as a maximum that could be assessed by the commission for a single violation. And should that violation continue then unabated for a number of days thereafter, then the commission would have the ability to assess an additional accumulating penalty of $10,000 per day following that. The reason for this change is that in a number of our enforcement actions, our present penalty section specifies that the commission can assess a penalty of $5,000 per day. Oftentimes that's adequate, but sometimes it's simply not adequate, and there are situations where the gravity of the offense could occur within a 24-hour period and escape a proper penalty simply by the shortness of the duration. So that identifies this. Secondly, the $10,000 per day brings Alaska into line with our survey of what the other states generally a prevailing penalty that exists across the other oil and gas producing states.
Okay, Mr. Norris, is there anybody that, there any parties that vehemently contest those numbers? Are there any parties that vehemently contest those numbers?
None that I know of, Mr. Chairman, but I would not want to purport to speak. We have done our best not to surprise anyone with this. We've done our best to give notice, but I believe it's probably most appropriate if other parties speak for themselves. But I can represent to you that I know of no one that vehemently or even at this point opposes these numbers.
Okay, good. Senator Stevens?
Well, thank you, Mr. I'm just trying. I'm not sure I understood the full implication of what you're saying, but we've gone from $10,000 to $5,000 a day, and the $100,000 figure was what? Where was that?
Yes, Senator Stevens, through the chair. The current statute provides that the commission may assess a penalty of up to $5,000 per day. So that's what we have to work with now, $5,000 per day. If a violation continued for 5 days, then the commission would have the ability, as an example, if it was a maximum violation, to assess a $25,000 penalty. This change that is being put forth would allow us to capture, we think, violations that might otherwise escape that simply because they occur within a short time period. So the proposal here is that for the initial violation, and that would be within a 24-hour period, or it could be as much as 1 hour, or it could, whatever the time period is, under proper circumstances, the commission could assess a $100,000 penalty. Then, if it continued after that, the commission could assess, as a maximum, a $10,000 penalty. I would underscore that those are maximum amounts, and the commission would anticipate assessing those only under the most egregious violations.
Okay. Well, thank you, Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All right. So continue on that. You have a question? Just continue on, Ms. Norman. Lead us through here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll continue under Section 14 where we are right now. There are and have been in the existing statute for some time also criminal penalties. Those would not be assessed by the commission. Those would fall under the criminal justice system, but the old penalty amount was a lower amount, and it made no sense, therefore, not to bring up to $10,000 at the same time that we're doing this housekeeping amendment. Subsection D, which is on page 8 of the draft that you have, increases the penalty for waste of valuable natural gas in Alaska. Currently, if the commission finds waste, that is, it could be either intentional or an operator's negligence, the commission can assess a penalty against that operator equal to the value of the gas. The commission believes that an adequate penalty for wasting the gas should not just be the value of the gas, but we would have the ability to assess double that amount. Another important subsection under 14 is subsection F, or correction, is subsection G, as it's now been combined. Under subsection G, there are set forth a number of specific criteria that the commission, this commission now or a commission 25 years from now, hopefully this commission will continue and go on for many years, but these are intended to give guidelines to the commission about what things should be considered when they assess a penalty. And I would expect that in an enforcement action that would come before us, we would work through this and apply them, and in our written decisions discuss them. So in effect, this is intended to put some sideboards on it so that we are not just able to assess penalties with unbridled discretion, if you will.
So this gives you a checklist to go through, and the other party would have the same checklist to refer to.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Senator Wagoner.
Yes, Senator Wagner.
And just digress a little bit. Under D, if I could ask Armin a question.
Yes, please.
On the penalty for each 1,000 cubic feet of natural gas flared or vented, how easy is that, John, to determine the amount of gas that has been illegally flared? Is that a pretty onerous process, or is that a fairly easy process to come up
with? It is fairly easy for the great majority, the huge, huge majority of proper operators in the state of Alaska, because there is a monthly gas disposition report that's filed with the commission every month that comes in. It crosses the desk of our engineers that review it, and it then has to be signed off and certified by a commissioner, currently our Commissioner Kathy Forrester. Under that, every disposition of gas has to be reported, and then if there are reasons, the companies will set them forth. If someone wanted to, and we don't think this is the case, so I don't want to imply it, but I would suppose it's somewhat of a voluntary reporting system, but if someone wanted to evade reporting, they could do it. But that would be awfully risky for an operator, frankly, because there are a lot of people that operate in the oil fields. We frequently get reports from employees operating in the oil fields and others, and this, I guess, leads back to a penalty. Were we to find out that someone had falsified a report, then that is what we consider to be at the very highest level of a violation of our statutes and regulations.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was wondering, because that's pretty much an honor system, that looks to me like. So, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Wagner. And I failed to mention, Senator Wagner has joined us online. Senator Stevens?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Why would you say you may impose a penalty for waste? Why would you not say you shall impose it? You talked about unbridled discretion. That seems to be pretty unbridled right there. Who decides, and how do you decide whether who you're going to let get by with waste?
Occasionally, and thank you for the question, Senator Stevens, and through the chair, the may addresses those situations where it could be a very close call. I could give you an example of an operator that had a gas transmission pipeline, and that pipeline experienced harmonic wind vibration. It vibrated and ruptured. The operator immediately dealt with the situation, fully reported it to us, and then embarked upon a study to try to figure out through a learning experience how it might be averted in the future, not just for that operator, but for others. We heard that, and we considered it, and so we try to take all of those things into consideration. Now, if that happened again, then it would perhaps be a different thing, but there sometimes is a fine line between what are acts of God or accidents, and a fire would have been is another example within the Cook Inlet Basin where gas was lost, and we looked into the cause of the fire, and we determined that it was not necessarily the result of any negligence. We still found that gas was wasted, so that the proper royalty and tax at that time under that determination would have to be paid, but beyond that, we elected not to penalize the operator.
I see. Thank you.
Okay, continue on, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I will now hit the high spots of the remaining sections of the bill. There is reference in here to the statutory authority, granting the commission the statutory authority to regulate the underground storage of natural gas. I think that you are all aware, particularly in the Rail Belt and Cook Inlet Basin, that we no longer are a stranded gas province. Gas is becoming an increasingly scarce commodity, and we no longer have the ability, guaranteed during peak periods of demand, to have operators open the valves and deliver all the gas that's needed. The operators are taking the necessary steps to try to identify spent out reservoirs that can be used for storage so that during the summer, for example, they can continue to produce and put gas into storage, and then in periods of peak demand, they can draw not only upon the reservoirs but also upon the storage. This is a common practice elsewhere in the United States, but heretofore, we've not had that specifically in black letter law granted to us. We do already exercise that authority. All the operators presume and assume that we have that authority, and it's our belief that we have that legal authority, but we would like, as a part of this cleaning up of the statutes, to have that in the law just to eliminate any one arguing about it in the future.
Okay, questions for Mr. Norman on the point? Okay, continue on.
Another section, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Senator Wagner, please.
John, right now, what's that? That's the two fields here on the peninsula, Swanson River and Kenai Gas Field?
And Kenai.
Swanson River.
Both in two fields. There are several several different injection wells, but the one field that's being used as a storage reservoir, Senator Wagner, through the chair, you're correct. Swanson River, a second, the Kenai, and then across the inlet over Pretty Creek. And we may see more of that in the future.
And that Pretty Creek, that supplies the generators there at Beluga, right? Or does that just go into the line going to Anchorage?
I can get you a specific answer. If I said right now, I'd want to double check my answer on that, if I could, Senator Wagner, and I'll find that out for you.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, and if I might add, Senator Wagner, Pretty Creek is a well-kept secret for both kings and silvers. So.
Not anymore.
I had that open to the whole peninsula.
Okay,
your secret will be safe with me, Mr. Chairman. another change in this statute is to include among the recitals of authority and responsibility of the commission a responsibility to oversee not just conservation, waste, fresh water, and so forth, but it also now specifically includes the word safety and public health. This is consistent with the 2004 version of the Model Oil and Gas Conservation Act promulgated by the Interstate Oil and Gas Combat Commission, and we're proposing it in order to keep Alaska in the forefront of having one of the best regulatory structures for oil and gas in the United States. Another change is two, and this I would describe as a slight course correction. In 2004,
Where are you speaking to in the bill?
Let me focus you on the section that I'm talking about specifically.
And we've been joined by Senator Stedman.
I'm speaking now, Mr. Chairman, to Section 5 of the statute. And currently, there is a requirement that in the exploration and development for coal bed methane, that there be a program instituted under the oversight of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission that would require well testing and development of baseline information. We are very supportive of this and supported that at the time that it went through. This is a very slight tweak or a bit of fine-tuning, if you will, because the wording of the statute says that when a well is drilled for production or, and the key words here are, or production testing of coal bed methane, that would trigger the requirement for this program. The production testing presents minimal risk to any freshwater supplies, because normally that occurs almost without exception in the exploration phase. An operator will then test to determine whether they have made a commercial discovery, if you will, to bring on to production. It's quick, and in our opinion and the opinion of the staff of the AOGCC, this activity presents no risk to freshwater supplies. If, however, the well then progresses to where it goes on to what is defined in our regulations as regular production, then, of course, that requirement would be there, and we would carefully monitor that to make sure that there's no degradation of freshwater supplies, wells in the area, things like that.
Thank you. Yep. Question, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. So basically, if I understand you, you are eliminating the commission's ability to require design and implementation of a well testing program if there is a situation where they're drilling, doing production testing. Is that correct?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the way I would say it right now is we don't really have the ability to require it. I believe the statute mandates that this be done. And a triggering event is the drilling, and then if an operator wishes to test and see if they've made a discovery, that triggers this program, which is expensive, and it isn't because of the expense we're recommending it, but it is very low yield, if next to nothing. There's no risk at all that I would represent to you to any freshwater as a result of production testing. If, however, the operator moves into regular production from that well, then all of the protections that are now in the statute would remain. So it's just this one small change.
If I just follow, as you know, it's a very controversial issue, big issue to those that who were concerned about their wells. And so what you're saying is there's absolutely no risk of well contamination in production testing for coal bed methane. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
0%.
Through the chair, it's not often that I would represent there's absolutely no risk, and I don't know if I'd go now, but all of life is a matter of cost-benefit analysis. But I would say in the things we regulate and the things that could go wrong every day, the drilling that's going on right now, this is minimal risk from just testing a well. The well's already been drilled, and it's down there, and the operator simply wants to test it to see if they should complete and bring it on to production. So it's that aspect that we're saying they should be allowed to go that far without triggering the requirement of this. Once it goes on to regular production, then the statute would require, as it does now, that there be this careful monitoring.
Additional questions?
No, I mean, if there's no risk, I don't have a problem with it. If there's a risk, then we're stripping your ability away to allow or require testing for it. So If there is no risk, then I can certainly understand that. But if there is a risk, I think at least there should be the option to require well testing.
Can you expand your conversation to address Senator Wilkowski's point?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've used here the word minimal risk, that in production testing it presents minimal risk. I suppose if I were writing it again, I would say minimal risk. I don't mean to be reserved, but it's very hard in life to give a guarantee that there's absolutely no risk. But I can tell you with total confidence that among all of the different things that we regulate, this is way, way, way down at the total bottom of the scale of presenting any risk or threat to fresh water simply by virtue of testing a well, running a flow test to see what gas might be there. The risk is involved once a well begins to produce. You pull out that pressure, you begin to get the water moving behind the gas, and that's where there is some possible risk that we would carefully monitor.
So it doesn't eliminate your ability to do testing at a time when production and the real risk potentially might come to fruition. Is that accurate, Mr. Norman?
Absolutely. That's absolutely the case, Mr. Chairman. And I think thinking about it and going one step further, if there was any area where we have the ability, before we approve a drilling permit, to impose conditions. So I don't see this as eliminating our ability to require a water monitoring test program when there's production testing. I just see it as giving us the flexibility to make a decision that, and if there is a professional judgment made that might at some point be needed someplace, then we could certainly attach that as a condition to the permit. Our permits that go out all the time have conditions on them, putting constraints on what an operator may and may not do. So I don't see this as eliminating our ability to do it, but I simply see it as eliminating what would ordinarily be a fixed requirement where we don't see the need for that to be done in every case.
Yeah, and Mr. Norman, if I might, this change, is it brought about because you've been lobbied by some industry?
No, sir.
Right.
This change was brought about and identified by the commission itself.
By the commission.
Yes, And it was brought about by, as sometimes happens after a law passes, as it's moving through and it evolves, and then you have the fullness of time, several years, to look at it and study it, it became apparent to us that this requirement, in our opinion, served no useful purpose.
Okay, thank you. And if I might, I don't know anything about coal bed methane. I read a lot once upon a time in the Frontiersman because we had a debate about coal bed methane exploration and the proprieties therein. And I was surprised recently being back in Washington, D.C., and they were at the energy conference and listening to people talking about different things. And a person from Colorado who says, you know, I'm kind of a green person myself, some degree if you ask some of my neighbors. And he says, but you know, coal bed methane is good for us in Colorado, though it's happening in Wyoming because we want the water from it. They saw the benefit of the water production there, and they were lobbying to be able, and they're looking to spend major bucks to be able to get. And on the other hand, the people in Montana on the other side were looking, saying, no, we want that water, and we think we're entitled to it. So the debate was about the residue of the water and not whether it was good or bad. They wanted ownership and use of it. And I was surprised by that. But please, continue on.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, just a brief footnote. I'm aware of that, and that has risen to the level of a debate between the governors of Montana and Wyoming over
right.
That particular issue. But I think you correctly identified it. Here in Alaska, we don't have the problem now, and we intend to watch it very carefully. And this simply, I think, I would say rather than restricting us, gives us flexibility to require it when we think it's needed. and it mandates it whenever any coal bed methane well is in production, but it gives us flexibility in other cases not to go through that process, which we would consider to be needless low yield testing.
Okay, good. Continue on.
Mr. Chairman, the Alaska Oil and Gas, just to set the stage quickly for my next comment, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission is one of the oldest regulatory agencies in the state of Alaska, and it was enacted as a pursuant to Chapter 4 SLA 1955. That's remarkable in that that's before there was any discovery of oil in commercial quantities here at Swanson River. It predates statehood, and I think it is a demonstration of some remarkable foresight on the part of those legislators. And I probably should have mentioned that at the outset, because we are taking an act that they worked with back in 1955 and amending it, and every time I do that, it's with some respect for the folks that originally worked on it. I think it was Albert Einstein that said the true mark of genius is not being able to solve complex problems, it's being able to anticipate where problems might develop and then deal with them before they develop. And I would point to this act of foresight on that 1955 legislature as putting in a framework and an oil and gas regulatory structure that has served us remarkably well over all these many years. That act, however, contained its own provisions about appeals from decisions of the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission.
What were you referring to in the bill?
And in this instance, I am referring right now to, let me focus you on the Section 10. These outmoded provisions from over half a century ago are continue to be carried forward in our law. When Alaska became a state, and then as we evolved, they were superseded by general rules applicable to appeals from all administrative agencies. The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation has consistently behaved as if we are operating under the general rules that apply to all agencies under general administrative law. Occasionally, we have had people contest this, and the confusion arises because under our statute, it says a person dissatisfied with the ruling may then go into court and on the retrial or trial de novo. And that has created confusion. In each case, we have prevailed, and most recently, we prevailed on a decision before the Alaska Supreme Court that came down last year. And for the record, I'll just briefly read that citation. The case is Allen v. the AOGCC, 147 Pacific 3rd, 664. So all this does is conform to what has consistently been the practice, and it also conforms to the recent ruling last year of the Alaska Supreme Court, and will take out a provision that is an artifact from 1955 when there were no other administrative agencies.
Questions or comments by members?
Can you just explain that to me again briefly on the trial de novo? What are you changing?
Yes. The 1955 Act in the section that is amended in Section 10 of the bill contains a procedure that says, in effect, I'm paraphrasing now, and
I know we've got a busy calendar, but essentially, if I'm understanding you correctly, current law allows trial de novo, and you're changing
current
that
law,
to
current
question
law
on appeal.
Current law appears to grant an automatic right to trial de novo. That's not been the position of the commission, and that has been upheld now by the Supreme Court. The question has been, did the judicial statute 2210.020 and the court rules of appellate procedure supersede this specific provision in our act? The Alaska Supreme Court has concluded that it has. So I think that that matter is now disposed of. And what this is simply cleaning up a provision that, if left there, might create confusion.
Thank you.
So this essentially brings alignment to the ruling to, in this case, the statute.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you. Continue.
Another provision, Mr. Chairman, and I'll try again to let me focus you on the, this is in Section 12 of the bill. We're proposing to eliminate the statutory fee of $100 for a permit to drill. In conducting a total review of our statutes, we looked at it. The $100 contributes about $25,000 a year toward a $4 million a year plus budget of the agency. The fee has not been changed for at least 37 years. And then before that, it was, I believe it started out in 1955 at $50. And then in 1970, it was changed to $100, and it's remained all these years. So we considered a range of options, including increasing the fee. Some states charge a fairly hefty fee. Other states don't charge. We considered the effect upon new companies entering Alaska. And we also considered and consulted with the current regulatory industry that pays the regulated well regulatory cost charge that funds the operations of the agency. And we've arrived at our recommendation here is to delete that $100 penalty. It doesn't really serve much of a purpose simply because many of the companies that pay the regulatory cost charge also wind up paying this $100 fee, which is then deducted from what they would otherwise pay. But it does cause a fair amount of accounting at the end of the year because you have to have a true up and then do an adjusted billing.
And the administration supports this provision?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Other questions or comments? Okay.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, so basically we're just cutting out this $100 fee.
And basically, that's correct. $100. We're cutting out the fee.
Does it cost $25,000 to do the accounting for that? Or anywhere near that?
It doesn't cost $25,000, but that $25,000 of receipts, or $20,000, if you take, let's say we have 200 permits a year, or 250, whatever it is, $20,000 to $25,000 is a reasonable number to work with. What we do then is we start out with the total amount needed to regulate the industry, and then that's a deduction. So there's no net gain one way or the other in that 25. In other words, we're not getting $25,000 more.
I see.
Okay, good. Okay, thank you. Continue on.
The next section, Mr. Chairman, is the one that we began with, which I would consider probably one of the most important, and that is the penalty amount. And I believe that I have explained that, but I would be happy to respond to any questions on that entire penalty section, which is Section 14.
Okay. Are there questions or comments from members on that? Okay, continue on past that.
Another provision in here, Mr. Chairman, relates to confidentiality of information. For a great many years, well data and applications for permits to drill, and I'm addressing now Section 7 of the bill.
Okay. Oh, Section 7. Section 7?
Yes, sir. Okay. Section 7 of the bill. This bill is intended to make more information public and to make that additional information public sooner than is the case now. And it does it in two ways. The first way is that we narrow the field of wells that would receive protection of confidentiality only to exploratory or stratigraphic wells. And those, the industry, we believe, has a legitimate reason to want to retain their proprietary information. It costs them a lot of money to drill those wells. The locations are carefully selected, and so we don't have a problem with that. But most of the wells drilled are development wells, and it's our belief that we can benefit and that the greater public good will be served by getting that information on those wells out to the public as soon as possible. And so we're proposing that what is now the 24-month period of confidentiality for those wells be eliminated, and that information would become immediate upon delivery to the AOGCC. A second part of this is to address applications for permits to drill. Historically, an application for a permit to drill has been treated as confidential, and except for certain information listed in the statute, has not been released for 24 months. Again, we are limiting that cloak of confidentiality only to exploratory and stratigraphic test well information, and then only to the information that the commission determines is proprietary, deserving of protection. The main thrust of this is to get more information out into the public and to avoid putting the commission in the position when a citizen says, could I see that application to drill? We say, no, you can't. We would like to be able to be as forthcoming as we can and present as much information, and at the same time strike a balance between the legitimate needs of the industry for proprietary protection.
So, Mr. Norman, in summation of that, this enhances public knowledge, not reduces. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And in your professional opinion and the commission's professional opinion, this is the right thing to do across the board?
That's correct.
Okay. Other questions or comments? Okay, continue on, please.
There is another provision in this bill that upon first reading might be a little difficult to follow, but what it says let me focus on that. Section 8, Mr. Chairman. Okay. In Section 8, essentially provides information voluntarily provided to the commission, which currently, by virtue of statute that's existed for a long time, a company can say, we are voluntarily providing this to you, but we want it kept confidential. And that's a benefit to us often. What this does, though, is make it clear that by receiving that in that fashion, we are not guaranteeing that in a future hearing or in the context of a future petition or application, that information will, that protection will carry over. At that time, the company will, that proceeding will have to stand on its own legs. And if a company again at that time can make the normal argument that we would require of them to do to receive confidentiality, we would certainly entertain that argument and extend it. But what we are eliminating here is any potential that a company might argue that today in 2007 we voluntarily provided this to you, so that now in 2010 when we're filing this petition, this information is already confidential. We're saying no, it won't work that way. We have to develop a public record that will support our decisions, and so if you're going to independently for some other purpose provide the information to us, then it must stand on its own and be re-scrutinized for confidentiality. Again, this is an intention to try to get, on this one, I wouldn't necessarily characterize it as trying to get more information out. I would simply say it's trying to anticipate a potential argument that someone in the future might make and eliminate any discussion on it.
Right. This does not reduce public awareness.
This does not reduce public awareness, no, sir.
Okay, thank you. Continue on.
Mr. Chairman, I think I have hit, I believe I have hit each of the high spots, and so speaking for the commission, I would just conclude that I and my fellow commissioners, Commissioner Kathy Forrester, Commissioner Dan Seamount, We believe this to be good legislation for Alaska, and we would recommend it to you for your favorable consideration and action.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Norman. Are there questions or comments? Yes, Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question on top of page 9E, talking about the someone who knowingly violates, I think is the phrase, $10,000 a day. Is that something that's often used? Is that an issue that you often use with $10,000 a day violation?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, subsection E that you're focusing on is not something that we would use other than if we ran into this, referring it over to the criminal division, but this is something that would be prosecuted criminally. We don't have the ability to impose any criminal sanctions, so it is, but it does give the entire state of Alaska, this is broader than our commission. Mm-hmm. The civil penalties that we can introduce are addressed in subsection A, and then this particular section says that where it is so willful that it rises to the level of a criminal violation, then it can also be prosecuted criminally and would constitute a misdemeanor.
No, thank you. And you're comfortable leaving that at a $10,000 a day figure?
I am, for this reason, that I think it's presumptuous of our commission to begin to delve too far into that. I'd be happy, though, on the notes that I'm taking, to again talk to the Department of Law, and if they feel that the number should be increased, then they can do it. I am comfortable that if we saw something that was a definite willful violation under subsection A, we have a number of tools that we can exercise, including, if this bill passes, a fairly hefty civil penalty. We also have the ability of, I will call it debarment, in other words, to refuse that operator other permits so long as they're in violation. And then we have the ability to take in an operator's conduct. If someone has a reputation as a consistently bad actor, that's one of the criteria here. So I'm comfortable with it the way it stands now. I think we've brought it as far as we can, and now it's up to the Criminal Division of the Department of Law to decide if they think they need to increase it.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments for Mr. Norman? If not, we will go to Mrs. Moriarty with the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. Ms. Moriarty, are you there?
I am, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Yeah. Would you put yourself on the record, please, and we would be glad to hear your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kara Moriarty, and I am the External Affairs Manager for the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. AOGA is the trade association for the oil and gas industry in Alaska, and our members account for the majority of oil and gas exploration, development, production, transportation, refining, and marketing activities in the state. And we thank you for the opportunity to comment today on Senate Bill 109. The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, as Commissioner Norman stated, is one of the oldest agencies in the state, dating back to 1955, prior to statehood. This important, independent, quasi-judicial agency oversees oil and gas drilling, development and production, reservoir depletion, and metering operations, and its funding is provided through a regulatory cost charge imposed on oil and gas companies operating here in Alaska. We thank the AOGCC and Chairman John Norman for undertaking this statutory update to clarify Bill 31, the Oil and Gas Conservation Act. AOGA did have several concerns with the legislation as originally introduced. However, the AOGCC has answered our questions, and we have a better understanding of the rationale for the suggested changes. With that said, AOGA currently has no major objections and supports the current committee substitute before you today. We look forward to continuing to work with the AOGCC on future statutory changes, and again, we want to thank Chairman Norman and his staff for helping us with our questions over the past several weeks. And I'd be happy to entertain any questions, and that concludes my testimony.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Moriarty. Members, questions or comments from Ms. Moriarty? And with that, now we will go to Alan Birnbaum, who is in Anchorage Department of Law. Alan, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. If you would put yourself on the record, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Alan Birnbaum. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Alaska Department of Law in the Oil, Gas, and Mining Section, and I'm here on behalf of the AOGCC.
Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Birnbaum. Are there any comments or relevant aspects of the bill that you think should be brought to members' attention?
No, not particularly. I think Mr. Norman did an excellent job of summarizing the bill and the changes. And just one point I'd like to clarify, just to make sure it's understood, that the last reference to Section 9E and the penalty for...
Yes, stand by one. Let us get to Section 9.
I'm sorry, Section 14E.
Section 14, okay.
Section 14E.
Okay, give us a page and line number.
Page 9, top of the page.
Okay, got it. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Birnbaum.
And I just wanted to clarify that the number in the original, in the bill, in the statute right now, is $5,000 a day, and that the proposed amendment would change that from $5,000 per day to $10,000 per day.
Yeah, Mr. Birnbaum, thank you for that clarification. Are there other items that you're aware of in the bill that are necessary for your clarification from a legal aspect?
No, there are not.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Birnbaum. Are there other parties online, or Senator Wagner, do you have any questions at this point in time?
No, I'm fine, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Are there other parties online that would wish to speak to this subject? Are the parties in the audience? Yes, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mark Lister. I'm a senior counsel for ConocoPhillips Alaska, Inc., and my comments today are very much like Ms. Moriarty's comments. We are, as we say in all our ads, the largest producer in Alaska and the most active explorer, so we have a lot of activities with the commission, and generally they're favorable. We have a good working relationship and respect the commission and its chairman and staff very much. First of all, we'd like to start by commending the chairman and staff for being so diligent in updating and clarifying its statutes. Not every agency takes the effort to reexamine their regulations and statutes with the kind of thorough and methodical process that Mr. Norman, Chairman Norman, has brought to his work, and we think that's a very healthy thing to do. We also very much appreciate his willingness to engage us when he's undergoing a process like that to make sure that we understand what he's trying to do and is very listens to our concerns and is very thoughtful and thorough in his response. And so it's been a very, I think, productive and confidence-building process, the way this statutory change has been embraced, and we appreciate that. And so we didn't necessarily get all of the things we wanted and all of our voices heard, but we always understood where Chairman Norman was coming from, and he understood where we were coming from. And so on balance, we support this bill, we appreciate the process, and we urge its passage.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Warshurst. We appreciate that. Questions or comments of members? Okay, thank you very much. Are there other personnel in the audience that have something to say or add on this? If not, do I have a motion to adopt the CS?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go ahead and make a motion that we adopt CS for Senate Bill number 109, version M, Bullock, dated 4/12/07.
Okay, is there objections? Hearing none, the CS is adopted. With that, are there other questions or comments by committee members at this time? Senator Wagner?
No comment.
Okay, thank you. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, not a motion. I just want to know if the agency ever celebrated its 50th anniversary. That's pretty remarkable, and we're coming up on statehood 50 years, and I hope you had some celebration or recognition of the work you've done for 50 years.
Yes, please.
Thank you for the opportunity to comment briefly on that. Yes, we are preparing right now a history which is somewhat a history of all of Alaska, but we are preparing a 50th anniversary history, and it'll be an interesting work, and we anticipate being able to widely distribute it, showing the evolution of the industry and all of the many people over the years that have contributed to this industry that is important, so important to our state of Alaska. But I thank you for the question, and we expect probably, I don't want to pin myself down, but we have it right now continuing to be written, gathering photos from people, gathering some of the pictures, and so sometime this year then we will have that particular celebration, and that will coincide with the completion of the history of the first 50 years of the AOGCC. Thank you for the question.
And Mr. Norman, before you depart, if I might, you know, I've known you probably a month or so at max, but I can tell you in that length of time, I personally have developed a great deal of respect for it. But more important than that, and listen to people, I get some that say you're their constituent, others say that they've dealt with you over the years. They're always very positive, and they say this guy, number one, may be the world's smartest person in his field of endeavor. I don't know about that part of it, but I know that any time that you've had something to say, it's been noteworthy. And if there was any critique, it was the fact that be careful sometimes. He's a talker. I commend you today for being brief, and we appreciate the contribution you made on the state of Alaska today, and we thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, all the members of the committee, for your courtesy.
Okay.
Would you like a motion, Mr.
Yes,
Chairman?
Yes, please.
I'd like to make a motion that we move Senate Bill 109 from committee as amended. Individual recommendations.
Thank you. And with a zero physical note, is there objections? Okay, hearing none, Senate Bill CS for Senate Bill 109 is moved from committee. And we will take a 2-minute recess. Next on the agenda is Senate Bill 96, Establishing Renewable Energy Fund. And Senator Ellis, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate you having this bill before you all today. This is a formidable group of people on this committee, and I appreciate being able to join you on a very timely and topical subject of renewable energy. You know, Mr. Chairman, Senator Stevens, Congressman Young, Senator Murkowski all mentioned renewable energy. It was almost like they had planned a chorus of support for some of the development of some of the resources we have here in the state. They've all been great champions, as we have, for development of our non-renewable resources, oil and gas resources, and others in the state. And now there's a recognition across the political spectrum about the value and wisdom of developing our renewable energy resources here in the state of Alaska. So it's timely, topical. The congressional delegation's on board. Support is building across the state. We have utilities and local governments coming forward asking us to do this. So it's not a fringe kind of issue. It's not an out there issue. It's a very mainstream, right here, right now kind of issue that we can be a leader on in the world and in the country with moving forward in this regard. High cost of energy, we don't need to bore the committee with that. We know what the squeeze that's going on with local communities across the state and with families' budgets. So it's very timely that we recognize that there is money to be saved and there is big money to be made in renewable energy. Money to be saved on, because this is essentially free power once the technology is in place and the technology is available, and money to be made by selling this power, money to be made by selling the technology, because the entire world is catching on to this, and we're lucky to have the resources here. We just need the foresight to develop them. Again, Alaska is widely known for our non-renewable resources, and we made a lot of money off of that, but we need to look ahead. And Alaska has excellent sources of renewable energy, such as wind, whether it's Kodiak Island, geothermal, solar, biomass, and hydropower, to name a few. So very exciting prospects. Senate Bill 96 is pretty straightforward, Mr. Chairman. It would give Alaskan communities the tools they need to harness these cleaner, more secure, cost-effective sources of energy. The bill establishes a renewable energy fund to be administered by the Alaska Energy Authority. AEA will take advice from an advisory committee with members appointed by the governor from various stakeholder groups. And the fund would offer both loan and grant options for Alaskan communities to develop alternative energy projects throughout the state. Senate Bill 96, in my humble opinion, Mr. Chairman, is a logical progression toward developing our inexhaustible energy resources. It means looking ahead to the next 100 years. Again, lots of money to be saved, lots of money to be made. There's amazing support for this building across the state. And to name just a few, there's the packet's growing, but the Mat-Su Borough, Southeast Alaska Municipal Conference, Alaska Municipal League, Chugach Electric, Golden Valley Electric Association, Alaska State Chamber, Alaska Federation of Natives, and Municipal Light and Power, to name a few. And the list grows daily. There are experts here to testify, Mr. Chair, but I just wanted to be the person to help speed this along with a brief presentation and sponsorship of the bill. I have no pride of authorship. This bill is improving as it moves through the committee process in both bodies. I hope we'll take advantage of some of the most recent versions of the bill when the vehicle comes before us. I think that'll be in very short order, as I just mentioned. Anyway, you can tell I'm excited. I think many of you are as well with the prospects here to look to the future, save some money, make some money. It makes all the sense in the world. There are folks who want to testify, and I will end my presentation so we can get on with that.
Thank you, Senator Ellis. Questions or comments for Senator Ellis? Thank you very much for hanging with us on a Friday afternoon. Mr. Peter Krimp, would you come forward, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Peter Krimp, Program Manager for Alternative Energy and Energy Efficiency with the Alaska Energy Authority. We appreciate the efforts to support further development of the state's renewable energy resources. I wanted to just speak very briefly about what sorts of energy resources we might see developed through this bill and other activities. The market for renewable energy has been increasing due to the increase in oil and gas prices, obviously. But hydro has been providing around 25% of the state's electrical energy for a long time. And there are many potential hydro projects throughout the southeast, rail belt, and rural Alaska that look promising. And they can range in size anywhere from a 200-kilowatt project in Chinook Lagoon to a 430-megawatt project up in the valley, Chacachamna Hydro. Wind also looks promising.
Excuse me there, if I might, Peter, would say again about Chacachamna Hydro?
Chacachamna installed.
Say it 10 times if you would.
Yeah.
Or Chimichanga, as it's also known.
Right.
No. Chacachamna Hydro is a preliminary FERC license has been submitted and is in place for Chacachamna Hydro, right. 430 megawatts in the. Right.
That's a tributary to the MacArthur River, right?
I believe it's the Chacachamna, but perhaps it is the MacArthur.
Okay.
It's over near Mount Spur.
Right. Flows out of a lake, comes into MacArthur. Right. Is it at the outlet of the lake? Is that the site where it's projected to be?
Well, you'd have to.
I don't mean to bog you down. That's okay.
Sure.
That's fine.
You'd develop as much head as you possibly could, so the powerhouse would be further down below.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Thank you.
Other resources, wind energy is through the state's rural energy plan has been shown to be cost effective in 30 to 45 locations in rural Alaska. Kodiak is developing an 8-megawatt wind facility. Golden Valley has been working toward developing a large wind farm near Healy. And of course, Siri, with a number of rail belt utilities, is moving forward on Fire Island Wind. So there is considerable activity happening in wind in the state. Again, the economics are improving. As far as geothermal goes, the Chena Hot Springs project up in outside of Fairbanks has shown that geothermal is looking pretty good at that project saving over displacing over 100,000 gallons of diesel per year, and the Alaska Energy Authority was involved in financing that through another program similar to a program which may come from the Renewable Energy Fund process. And of course in the valley also we're looking at a potential project in the valley at Mount Spur of 25 to 100 megawatts, and that project is in the development phase, and AEA and other entities are quite eager to move forward on investigations in that area. Wood is abundant throughout the interior and in areas where there isn't wind. It's sort of fortunate. The wood resources in the southeast and south central and in the interior where the beetle kill has taken its toll and down the Kenai are considerable. There has been a lot of activity in that area looking at small-scale thermal applications, heating schools, community facilities, looking at small-scale modular biopower technology, looking at innovative harvesting techniques. Of course, there has been work in Southeast in looking at cellulosic ethanol development. That has been in the offing, or in progress, I should say, with Sea Alaska for 3 or 4 years. The economics of that are still questionable. The technology is under development, but the small-scale thermal is looking fine. AEA and our utility partners are continuing to work in other areas such as fish oil, biodiesel, tidal, in-stream kinetic, using the flow of rivers in the interior and elsewhere to generate power. other areas. I'm happy to answer any questions. I wanted to just give a quick overview of what the state may see in terms of projects in this program.
I have questions for Peter. Peter, I actually have one question for you. I listened to a conversation amongst some forest people, I don't know, a month ago, let's call it. And they were talking about birch bark and pellets. You have any feel for that? How there's a market for it? Number one, I was told it was very clean. Number two, is a fairly high BTU concentration in the pellets. Any thoughts on that or feedback?
There has been interest, and we at ADA and AEA have responded to questions of interest in financing pellet manufacturing facilities, either as an industrial-grade pellet that could be used to produce power in a conventional power plant, as well as just kind of a residential market, feeding a residential market. In terms of the relative clean burning nature of pellets, I think just about all pellets from all species burn quite cleanly, and they've been widely used throughout the lower 48.
Okay. And final question for you. Once upon a time, we had the Susitna Hydro project. What makes you think the Chacachama will be any different than the Susitna Hydro?
The Susitna project and the Chacachama project are obviously large projects with potential impacts that would need to be studied before they move forward. I certainly wouldn't want to portray the Chacachama project as a go. It's got many, many hurdles in terms of power market, fish migration, economics that would have to be leaped over. And obviously the Susitna project had many of the same impacts right. That needed to be considered.
Okay, good. And maybe finally, would you share with us your background on how you got into this business?
Sure. I've been working at the Alaska Energy Authority for 14 years now. I sort of moved up through the ranks. I am a forester by background and a planner, got hired on to manage the state's the biomass energy program. So that is my area of technical expertise, but I've expanded my duties onto the economic analysis side and overall project planning.
Okay, good. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you, Peter, very much. And next we have with the Alaska Energy Authority, Ms. Sarah Fisher Goad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sarah Fisher Goad. I'm Deputy Director of Operations for Alaska Energy Authority. I think Peter Krimp from our agency has done a good job on an overview of renewable energy projects and our efforts and where we see some potential projects in the state. I'm actually going to keep my testimony very brief and just actually be available for questions. If there's any questions with respect to what you see with Senate Bill 96 as it was introduced versus some changes that have gone, that the bill on the House side, the companion bill, House Bill 152, has been through. I guess the one thing I will point out that has been the most significant change, I believe, in the bill, which was based on our recommendation in the House side, is instead of having this renewable energy fund be a combination grant and loan fund, we had recommended and the House has agreed that the loan provision be removed from the renewable energy fund. The loan provision is actually a duplication of an existing program that we have right now, the Power Project Fund. And so what you see with the committee substitutes of House Bill 152 is a recognition that the Power Project Fund is available for loans for renewable energy projects, and that left the renewable energy fund in the current House version of the bill to be just for grants. And thanks, Mr. Chairman, for this opportunity to testify. I am here to answer questions about, you know, the bills or also the fiscal notes that you have before you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Fisher Goad. Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe you can help me understand. I'm looking on the Senate bill, which is the one before us, Senate Bill 96 on page 4. And just so I understand, the bottom of the page, it says it must link a renewable energy project or natural gas project to the electric grid. And I guess my question is just, what does that mean? Is that, that's not an inner tie, that's, I guess I need to understand what a grid is. Is it going to be like a small community of 10,000 people and just that local usage? Is that a grid?
Senator Stevens, I believe that is one that is something that has changed in the House version of the bill, and I believe in the new language in the House version pushes transmission or distribution infrastructure. And it doesn't refer to the electric grid. That was something that I think there were questions on what that actually meant.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Fisher Goad. Other questions or comments for Ms. Fisher Goad? Next, we're going to go to our good friends in Nome. Mr. Mitch Erickson? Hello, Mr. Erickson. Are you with us in Nome?
Yes, I am.
Oh, very good. Would you please put yourself on the record?
Yes, thank you. My name is Mitch Erickson. I am the Executive Director of the Nome Chamber of Commerce. I'm here as the Executive Director to support SB 90. The Nome Chamber of Commerce held a two-day energy summit to look for alternatives to diesel in both community power generation and home heating. This was conducted in April 2002. This energy summit was spurred by the 20% annual increases in diesel fuel prices over the past several years. Very few people receive pay raises to match this annual cost of living. Some locals are seeing their winter heating and utility bill is higher than their mortgage payment. That said, our day one of the energy summit was dedicated to the big picture project with the goal to wean our community from diesel as a primary source of energy. We had experts address wind, hydrogen, solar, geothermal, nuclear, as well as the funding and financing available. We did have members of Alaska Energy Authority as participants. The city of Nome is now conducting an energy study along with the Department of Energy and Alaska Energy Authority, and I believe that came out of our energy study or summit. Day two was dedicated to what individuals and businesses can do to lower their energy costs. This included the insulation, windows, light bulbs, as well as wind and solar as a secondary source of electric. One point that came out of our energy summit was the need for a fund such as Senate Bill 90. We fully support this bill and only hope that it is funded to an adequate amount yet to be determined. I have one additional comment to make. As a chamber, we are working on an individual basis with businesses and households looking for alternative energy sources. We have found that solar energy is an excellent potential as a secondary source for both home and business electrical generation and hot water heat. However, over the past year, we have not been able to find an in-state expert to work with us, our local businesses, our contractors, or individuals. We are now trying to develop a relationship with the University of Minnesota Solar Energy Lab for the technical expertise. I thank you very much.
And thank you, Mr. Erickson. Questions or comments for Mr. Erickson? Mr. Erickson, if you would indulge us for a moment, what's the weather like in Nome today?
It is sunny and 29 degrees.
Oh, very good. And please give our best to your mayor.
I will. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Next, we're going to Dillingham. Mr. Anderson?
Hello. Nels here.
Hi, Mr. Anderson. Nels, it's Charlie Huggins here in Juneau. Could you put yourself on the record? We would love to hear your testimony in Senate Bill 96.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Nels Anderson, Jr.
I am a former state senator and House Majority Leader. I am currently chair of the Southwest Alaska Municipal Conference Energy Committee, and I am a member of the Bristol Bay Alternative Energy Task Force. Senate Bill 96 is needed because most of our villages are almost totally dependent on diesel for their electricity. High crude oil prices are driving diesel costs up, and as a result, electricity is very expensive. Many villages pay from 50 to 75 cents a kilowatt hour for their electricity. Most individuals spend any available money on lighting and heating their homes. And Senate Bill 96 needs to pass as soon as possible. And under Senate Bill 96, under legislative findings, I think the legislative findings are a compelling argument for the need for Senate Bill 96. And we believe that the Alaska Energy Authority can do an excellent job in implementing this renewable energy fund. And we believe that Senate Bill 96 is the key to unlocking all of our remarkable renewable energy sources that we have in Alaska. So we ask you, Senators, please pass this as soon as possible. We need all the help we can get out here to survive. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Nels, and thanks for your past service to Alaska and your country. Questions and comments for Mr. Anderson? And thanks again, Nels. And to be consistent, how's the weather in Dillingham?
It's partly cloudy, and it's about 42 degrees.
Oh, very good. Is it raining?
No rain coming down yet.
Okay, good. Well, thanks again, Nels. Next, we're going to go to Mara Kohler with Alaska Village Electric.
Hello, this is Mira Kohler. I'm the president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, and we're based in Anchorage, Alaska. And I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 96. AVEC, as some of you may know, is a nonprofit electric utility that serves 52 villages, primarily in northwest and western Alaska. Our 21,000 residents represent almost half of Alaska's village population. We operate 47 power plants, all of which are almost exclusively diesel. Since the year 2000, we have made tentative efforts to add a few renewables, primarily wind. Well, only wind. We now have supplemental wind generation in four of our villages, and the benefits of those four wind farms flow to another two communities through interties. One more intertie is being built, so a seventh community will be on wind by the end of this year. We are also planning two more wind projects this year and another two potentially next year. These projects have been almost exclusively funded with federal dollars and with local dollars. Very little or no state dollars are involved in any of those projects. Utility-grade wind generation in Alaska is very expensive. We can only use small wind turbines, and our construction costs are staggering due to our Arctic and subarctic conditions. And that is why development of these projects is very slow. Other technologies are only just emerging. Alaska needs a renewable energy bill. It establishes a mechanism to systematically support the development of renewable power sources in our communities. Alaska is blessed with enormous potential renewable energy sources. The advisory committee that's established by this bill will work with the AEA to provide the focus that the state needs to evaluate and develop these resources. We all realize there are some differences between SB 96 and HB 152, which is currently going through the House, but we are supportive of both versions of these bills and are supportive of all of your efforts to implement renewable energy in our state. So I urge you to pass the bill as fast as you possibly can. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Kohler. Questions or comments for Mrs. Kohler?
Mr. Chairman, it's Tom Wagner.
Hey, Tom.
Ms. Kohler, is there any thing that you can relate to the committee at this time on any reduction in high percentage or whatever as far as the wind generation versus diesel electric generation at this time?
The most success that we've had to date actually are the two most recent projects that we installed that became functional last year in Kosiegluk and in Tuxuk Bay. Those are both excellent wind regimes, and we have had, we have exceeded our expectations in production from those during the high wind months of this last winter. We actually had, I think in the month of January, we displaced more than 30% of our diesel fuel in both of those communities. So during the period when you do have high wind regimes, you can actually displace a very significant amount of fuel. And our cost of fuel in those communities is running about $2.50 a gallon. So 30% of 130,000 gallons can be a very significant number in a small community.
Yeah, that'd be huge. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, and thank you, Ms. Kohler. For the other people that are online, I'm going to ask that you rejoin us the next time we bring this bill back up. And on behalf of Senator Ellis, the sponsor of the bill, say thank you very much for tuning in with us today. Unfortunately, some of us have to go to a follow-on committee meeting. But with that, we say thank you very much for coming online. And for those that were able to testify, thank you. For those that were not able to testify, we'd ask you to join in with us next time. We will notify you in advance when that committee meeting is going to be. And with that,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Wagner.
Yeah, you didn't ask me how the weather is in Kenai today.
No, we thought you were napping. You were on recorder or something. How is the weather in Kenai?
The weather, shirt sleeve weather right now.
What's the temperature?
I don't know what the temperature is, but it's not raining.
Okay, very good. Hey, Tom, have a good weekend.
Yeah, we'll see you Monday, Charlie.
Tell Dorothy said hello.
All right.
Okay. And we're adjourned.